I hope everybody got some rest. I am talking to too many overloaded, panicked people. I suppose that's in part because a fair number of the people in this room have only 1 year of this law school to deal with, and the end of the first term is the panic time. But I do want to remind you of something which those of you who were in my first year class have heard before, which is that notwithstanding everything that you think you know, grades simply do not matter. Those people who were my first year students in this room know that we worry about a phenomenon known as being shot by invisible bullets. The projectiles fired at you by the grading system do not exist. They're not real. The implicit and sometimes irresponsibly explicit claim that grades determine your occupational futures, which is purely a myth, is nonetheless so powerful that it can wreak actual bodily harm on you despite not existing. I am a person who hires lawyers all the time. My practice hires lawyers continuously. So when I speak about what it means to hire a lawyer, I'm not speaking in a hypothetical fashion or in some law professor bullshit way. I know how I hire lawyers. I have been hiring lawyers for almost 20 years now, and in that time I have never, ever, ever read a transcript. Transcripts are useless to me as a person hiring lawyers. In the first place, if a transcript has something on it which is really important good news, like I was a Kent Scholar, I won the Sears Prize, it will say so in the cover letter and I will know it already. But more importantly, I have never hired a lawyer without interviewing the lawyers I was thinking about hiring. And there is nothing, that one of my colleagues, no matter how distinguished or how much my friend, there is nothing that a teacher in this law school can tell me by putting a letter on a transcript that I cannot figure out by spending 45 minutes with a human being. So I do not read transcripts because they have nothing to offer me. It's not that I am making an effort of principle not to read a transcript. It's that a transcript is a meaningless document for my purposes. Transcripts are useful only for hiring bureaucracies, machines with a slot for putting a transcript in at one side and emitting offers to come down and be interviewed at the law firm on the other side. And that doesn't really matter to you because your goal is not to be canned meat, where the label on the can is what determines what people know of you. Your goal is to be a lawyer. A lawyer is a person who makes things happen in society using words. That's the definition of lawyering in my first year course. Getting a job is one of the things you make happen in society using words. The quality of your lawyering is what gets you the job, not the quality of your exam taking, and certainly not the transcript, which is a bare moonlight reflection of what you did as a student. Yet, term after term, life after life, for 3.5 decades now, I have been watching people destroyed by bullets that didn't exist. Hurt, harmed, made anxious, made terrified, made sleepless, made poorly performing, made desperate. Sometimes worse. For what? Exactly. So, you need to be aware. I mean, if you don't want to be injured by bullets that don't exist, you need to be aware. But it's really hard. Mythology actually determines the quality of lives. That's why myths work. We were talking last time about what happens in the loss of autonomy when your society decides, if you're punctual, that you don't exist anymore. Now consider in the low-tech version. When I arrived in this law school in 1987, grades were posted on the wall by social security number. And there was therefore a thriving practice in trading social security numbers for de-anonymizing the grades on the wall, so people could study one another's grades. As you can imagine, we have improved a lot since then. We deliver them directly to you. And oddly, by doing so, we multiply the harmfulness. If you could actually behave as though the grades didn't exist, they would not hurt you. And you would not be hurt by the pretense. Naturally, because I attended the Yale Law School, like all the other professors, I didn't have grades in my first semester of law school, because there aren't any. It's pass-fail, and everybody passes. And that's a very good idea. When I got to Columbia in 87 and 88, when we were changing the first-year curriculum, I was a big proponent of the proposal of the pass-fail first semester, the only part of the curricular reforms of 1988 we didn't actually enact, most of the rest of which we did enact, we've taken back since then and regressed. But that one we never even managed to sort of make. The knockdown argument against the pass-fail first semester was offered by a very distinguished and for me at least, deeply respectable colleague of mine, who said in the faculty as we were discussing the pass-fail first semester, but if we don't give them grades, how would we give them feedback? There are about a dozen people who have not received the feedback on their first essays that I intended you to have weeks ago. I held them in order to rewrite my comments, which seemed to me less than ideally helpful. You'll have them by Friday. Everybody else has them now. Feedback is not hard. It's not difficult to describe substantively how to help people learn. The difficulty is that it takes work, but wikis are very good at reducing the amount of work it takes, which is why nobody uses them. Everybody is trapped in the same system. The projectiles are aimed at you, but the harm is done to more than you. It's done to teachers also. It's what my dear friend William Blake meant when he said, everywhere the mind-forged manacles I hear clanking. Trapped inside a system which doesn't maximize your ability to learn or maximize the pleasure that you take in learning, but that does indeed quite seriously maximize your anxiety around this time of year. It's a product. You paid for it. Hope you like it. With respect to our work in particular, the following is true. Your job was to write a bad first draft, and when I told you that you had and you laughed nervously, you thought maybe I didn't really mean it. And now you have some comments, and so we see, yeah, it was a bad first draft. It was. That's good. That's fine. One of the things which is happening as people respond to my responses is that people feel bad, whether angry bad or guilty bad depends on the nature of the human being, but people feel bad because they don't know enough technology. And so people are apologizing or feeling they should apologize or being angry at me for making them feel they should apologize for not knowing the tech. But once again, this isn't you. This isn't me either, but it isn't you. It's us. It's the system of technology which really doesn't want you to understand it. The automobile, which was the primary technology of the 20th century, at least until late in the 20th century, the society wanted people to learn about, mostly boys. It was content that girls shouldn't know anything about cars, but it thought that boys should know about cars. And particularly the kinds of boys who it didn't know how otherwise to educate, it taught them about cars. And that was good because they were shop rats and they worked on cars and they had access to the dominant technology of the society. Late in the 20th century, when the polluting emissions from automobile engines came to be an issue, Detroit became an early proponent, an early user of small computers, and began to use computers to control the emissions from automobile engines. And in order to do that more effectively, the automobile engine became a sealed box to the shop rat who wanted to work on it. Diagnosing engines without special machinery for diagnosing engines became difficult. You couldn't work on carburetors anymore because there were no carburetors. And the knowledge of how the automobile actually worked declined in society. The automobile is, of course, no longer the dominant machine in 21st century society, not even the electric car. Software is the dominant machine in 21st century society. Not just the physiology of the net, but the physiology of pretty much everything, how they work. And society has very little interest in your knowing about software. This varies from society to society. One of the extraordinary developments of the Indian economy in the late 20th and early 21st century was the extent of the effort to make software knowledge accessible to people, because it was a dominant industry in which India could excel, because, as Bill Gates famously remarked, software is an IQ business. And if you have a lot of brains, you have a lot of smart brains. And if you put those brains to work, and oddly, for a fundamentally misogynistic society, if you put all the brains to work, not half the brains. Lawyers in Indian cities mostly work in residential neighborhoods with their office premises inside residential neighborhoods. And when SFLC.in was looking for office space in Jungpura back 4 or 5 years ago, and I happened to be there, we spent an awful lot of time looking at apartments. Often, the occupied apartments of families in the same building where the landlord would have offered us a professional space in the same line of apartments. And walking into the bedroom of a 12-year-old Indian girl in New Delhi, I was amazed at how often there was programming Ruby on Rails books on the shelf over the desk. But American society, and indeed even Indian society, if you're going to be a lawyer, it doesn't really think you should know about software. And software knowledge to you is mostly inaccessible. There is no software and computing from soup to nuts for lawyers course available to you if you wanted to teach it, if you wanted to take it. The kind of knowledge that you need in order to understand the technology which rules not just the society, but society, not just some human beings, but the human race. The kinds of learning that you would want in order to learn optimally what you as lawyers and policymakers need to know is not available to you. The knowledge is exotic. If you're not going to work at Facebook, why should you know how Facebook works? Indeed, why should you? So part of what is happening as you try and write about these things, and I insist on saying everything is technology and politics and law, and you have to take them together, is that people come up against barriers in their knowledge and even in their ability to learn. Where would I find out what I need to know? And so part of my work as an editor is contributing strength where your particular bunches of skills need strength. And that leaves people feeling inadequate because of the grade. Because I'm supposed to demonstrate mastery of everything in every first draft, because the first draft is the only draft, the exam is live today, never again, and the grades really matter. The level at which those concepts reinforce one another to disempower you is not just our experience of this course, it's the subject. It's the purpose of this course to confront that. And even so, this course is not computer technology from soup to nuts for lawyers. This is trying to focus on the meaning of the thing. So, of course, my job is to do that teaching interstitially. If it feels bad, I am sorry. I don't want you to feel bad. It's not your inadequacy I am correcting. But we all have to learn this stuff one way or another. And at least from my point of view, what a teacher does is to meet the students where they are. So I want you to write about things that matter to you. And then I want us to make them better. And being edited always feels a little awkward. Even professional writers don't respond well to being edited much of the time. I've had professional writers refer to the editing process they were going through in projects they were working on, using every kind of metaphor of violence, sexual and personal and financial, and because being edited is uncomfortable. But every interaction is capable of helping you learn, And every failure to help you learn isn't your failure, it's my failure, and I'm used to it by now. I fail a lot, and we try and get better. So, some people would probably like to hand in a first draft of the second essay next Wednesday on the last day of classes and be done with it. Please do so. Some people feel a little bruised or uneasy or don't have first comments yet, and even by Friday it's too much. I've got 5 courses, I'm overloaded, I'm doing 12 things. Do what makes sense for you. You have the time to do the work you need the way you need to do it. If you want everything to stretch out past the end of the term into next term, which I do not recommend, click the button, send me email, I need a writing. All I need is a writing. If you ask for an extension on your work, I will automatically extend it to February 1st. You just have to write to me. If you really want to go past February 1st, you shouldn't. You're going to be just as overloaded next semester. It's not going to be. But if you really want to, fine. Write me and say so. I'll do it. I don't care. My job is not to make it quick. My job is to make it right. Questions about this? Those, maybe. Okay, nobody has any questions because everything's fine. Fine, I tell you, fine. Fine. That's good. 3 people in this room handed in TwikiGuest first essay. Well, 3 people in this course, 2 people in this room, handed in TwikiGuest first essay. And they handed it in on top of one another. So it's really hard for me to comment on TwikiGuest first essay because there are 3 of them there. And if you don't know whether you did or not, I will help you by sending you an email later. You should go and disambiguate. If by any chance you don't have a copy of the thing you handed in as first essay, TwikiGuest first essay, rather than your own, we can fetch it from the history of that page. You needed to be logged in when you pressed the button that said first essay, and then you needed to stay logged in until you saved it, because otherwise you weren't logged in and it thought you were TwikiGuest, and so it filed it under TwikiGuest first paper and it's stacked up there. But it's okay. Everybody else that didn't happen to, I try and make it hard. I don't know exactly how it happened, and I would love to know. But everybody else's papers are in the right place, filed correctly. And if you don't have comments, it's because I held them up for rewriting, and I'll be done tomorrow or Friday. Deadlines are flexible, but I have stated them, so you have structure. The rules require me to ask you not to call me up or see me in the hall and say, can I have an extension? You have to write it down. That's our only requirement to keep the occupation at bay. Everything else will work on your schedule. And I will tell you, no, that's not how the technology works. It works like this. Let's take that into account when we finish this essay. That's one of the things I will say. I don't always say it. I sometimes say other things like, I can't make any sense out of this at all. Rewrite this paragraph, but you know how it is. Oh, the comments are either in the middle or at the bottom or both, and they're in red ink, and they're sometimes very long. And sometimes it would be a good idea to read the comments on other people's papers, not for Schadenfreude, but for information. On Lewis's paper, I think it is, there's a passage in my comments on how to understand algorithms and AI, which it would benefit other people to read, too. I didn't turn it into a separate wiki topic. I just put it in those comments, and then I realized that they were of more general applicability, but you should read them. The problem of why everybody talks about algorithms and algorithmic transparency all the time and why that's a bunch of crap, it is useful to have an explanation for. And I wrote it down, and it's over there. And then there are a couple of other papers in which something else of utility was put in the comments. So you may find it valuable to look through other people. When you revise a paper, just throw away the existing text of every kind and put your new version down on top of it, because the wiki stores every single version. So you don't have to leave my comments there as though they were sacred or, oh my God, I am disturbing Eben's red ink, how can I do that? You just throw it away and you put the new version in place, and the old version is still there. And in fact, I use programmers' tools, diff-like processes, to keep track of every single diff between each version of each document. You can model that for yourself by pressing the history button on any page and then saying, show me all the diffs on the page on the history panel. And you'll see that the wiki can reproduce everything in the form of a minimal indication of the differentiation between each two versions of the page. I actually use a tool like that to visualize all the changes in the wiki made by any individual person to all the different things that there are. Every change to your essays, every change you made to anything else. And that's how I compile the portfolio of each student out of the wiki, which I use to evaluate the work and produce the wonderful, horrible, tremendously important, life-changing grade. So, have I answered your question satisfactorily? Any other process questions like that? So my effort has been for 12 weeks now, minus the Wednesday we didn't get because, well, whatever. My effort has been for 12 weeks to state a problem, not in the form of a single question or a single objection, not in the form of a problem like it is stated in a law textbook or in a case, but a problem in the sense of an understanding of who we as human beings are and what is happening. I don't need to refine that past the cartoon level now. So the cartoon level is we are building a nervous system which embraces all of the human race and which changes the fundamental nature of how individuals participate in the life of the society around them and most importantly how they learn. We are moving to a world in which within the next generation after yours, all human minds will be formed in relation to that extraskeletal species-wide nervous system from birth to death, and the machine will become the primary teacher of human beings. The phases in long, deep history of human existence can best be periodized, defined for historical purposes in relation to how human beings learn. For the first 4.5 million years, roughly speaking, of the human beings various evolutionary stages since the time we split off from our chimp cousins and the similar near hominid apes. For the first 4 million years or so, the form in which teaching occurred was by example, human to human. Without articulate, complex spoken language, learning was done in the body and by imitation, person to person. We can call that the first era of the human race. It's very long and very powerful and completely unwritten, naturally, and therefore not just prehistoric, but pre-prehistoric, and we don't think very much about it, except as anthropology. The second era of the human race began roughly 200,000 years ago. It doesn't fossilize. We can't easily dig it out of the ground, but we can see the evidence of the onset of articulate, complex spoken language. Once human beings, and there are several forms of human beings, right? Our siblings, Neanderthal, Denisovan, Floreliensis, all the pieces of the human race, separately acquiring language, we know they did. You wouldn't have a substantial amount of Neanderthal genes in you, which you do if you are a European or Asian descended person. You wouldn't have substantial quantities of Neanderthal genes in you if there hadn't been substantial interbreeding between Neanderthal and the sapiens version of Homo. But that means that both Neanderthal and sapiens human beings possessed articulate spoken language. It is very difficult to imagine a sustained process of interbreeding and cultural connection between beings capable of language and those incapable of language. So articulate spoken language evolved in the human race separately more than once, across probably all of our nearest kin. And from that time on, teaching consisted not merely of imitation of action, but of learning by precept. Cultural evolution of the human race then speeds up substantially, but still in connection person to person. Not substantially different from what 200,000 years or so later is happening in this room. We are talking to one another. mostly I am teaching. That is to say, there is an assumption that I am the one who need not learn. But no one who has ever taught believes for an instant that learning occurs only on one dipole of that relationship. About 5,000 years ago, we began to write. Writing produces, among other things, the state, the extended forms of social power that no longer depend upon face-to-face contact in the tribe. But writing also produces the most powerful mode of teaching that human beings ever achieve, a form of teaching which allows learning to go on at distance without the immediate relationship of the teacher. Though writing, of course, turned out to require, as human beings mastered the sophisticated ways in which learning could occur, a return to the underlying human-to-human quality of teaching. That also is now happening in this room. But you only need to look at what people's eyes are focused on at the moment to see where the fourth error comes from. A generation from now, the machine will be the primary teacher of human beings. And another whole structure in the history of human life will have commenced. You are living through that transformation now. This chorus is really about that change. The problem, then, isn't how do we solve that? How do we make it not occur? How do we prevent it? The question is, what will the fourth era of the human race be? And as I said at the beginning, quoting my friend Dan Deer, who was there at the beginning of the net, as I was there at the beginning of some of the software entities we are thinking about, as Dan once wrote, this is the last generation in which the human race gets a choice. So this course is about what is that choice, and how do we descriptively and normatively go about making it now, in your lifetime, the last generation in which the choice is actually there. Later, it will have been made. In the lives of your grandchildren, that choice will have been made, and it will have been made by the people who were you. That's what I have been talking about for the purpose of illustrating, expositing, adumbrating that condition, how it is at work. Here, in this course, I have been talking about that primarily within what we think of as civil society, that is, society in all its relations which aren't those involving government backed by the implicit or explicit monopoly of force. In a couple of weeks, after we've all had a rest and these hated grades have been developed and delivered, I will be teaching the second half of what I think this is about. That is to say, what it does to the meaning of the state. The state was, after all, the creation of the third era of the human race. What it becomes in the fourth era of the human race, when the machine is the teacher of everyone, is what we will now be deciding in our constitutional relationships in your lifetime. That's that course. This is this course. But the week spent showing what the condition is, conditions, really, from the internet as a condition in society to the engagement-focused life of the parasite with the mind of God as a condition, to the building of software entities in which engagement is the primary objective of the software physiology, and where engagement means the stimulation of strong emotions that overwhelm thought in human beings, humiliation, the desire to humiliate, envy, hatred, FOMO, and so on, which aren't the feelings that we have in our new nervous system. The emotions to which our new nervous system gives rise, the forms of thinking that that new nervous system encourages, and the forms of thinking which it discourages. Those conditions are what I have been speaking about. It is perfectly justifiable to expect that at some point I'm going to stop talking about the conditions and start talking about what to do. Everybody talks about the weather, said Mark Twain, but nobody ever does anything. It's a fair point. And I didn't just come here to teach a course about the weather. My occasional co-author Karl Marx is correct. Philosophers have studied the world, but the point is to change it. We're in law school, using words. So it's time to devote some words to changing it. And this week and next week, as we get ready for the pause, I mean to do that. I'm not betting that everything I have to say will come as a surprise. I think you understand. I've telegraphed most of my punches by now. I didn't have any desire to do otherwise, but it's not just summing up. I'm trying to push the matter forward. So, from that point of view, what I have said tells us that we should expect to have technology and law and politics to deal with, to address our new conditions, to address them in some specific ways and with some specific social purposes, which I am certainly not hiding, and which I believe, again, address themselves fundamentally at the root, which is, how are we about to change teaching, the process of acculturation? How are we evolving when, as human beings, we are Lamarckian rather than Darwinian creatures, evolving through the inheritance of acquired characteristics? Which, then, of the acquired characteristics of the human race of the last 5,000 years should we be keeping, and which should we be changing, and which should we be allowing the net to change for us? Addressed at this level, of course, there are 1,000 forms of questions. Cybersecurity, free speech and expression, national security, and so on. All of which are descriptions of physiological processes in society. And one could address all the things that we have been talking about and that I'm now going to talk about from each of those particular directions, but that's not what I want to do myself. I know what the last 40 years roughly of my life were about. That is to say, I know what thinking about these problems in my childhood led me. That's my value, like the value of all dying persons who have come to the end of long lives. I can tell you what I saw. And some portion of this is, after all, me telling you what I saw. I try to limit that for reasons that are purely intrapsychic, my own modesties or doubts that I will be believed or whatever. But part of what I am working from is the recognition that none of this was unexpected. Not by me, anyway. In the last year of my father's life, the last time we were all on vacation together, at the very end of the last millennium, in year 2000, I said to him, in the 21st century, the single greatest social privilege will be the ability to unplug from the net. As usual, he didn't know what I was talking about, but it was an important subject between his son and his dying father. As it was when I said to him the year I was 16, I have two brains now, one made of carbon and one made of silicon, and they're different. And that freaked him out very much, because it crawled his skin, if you like. But it was an important statement from a son growing up to a father letting go. When I was 12, or 13 really, when I said to him, in the future, the human race will consist of two classes of people, those who know how to change the behavior of computers and those who don't, and those who don't will be the slaves of those who do. He thought I was nuts. I was. Because I didn't understand that all of them were going to be slaves of the machine. That was inconceivable to me, because I knew how to change the behavior of computers, and they were never going to do it to me, and they didn't. And so I stand here as a relic of a world in which I make my own machines, I make my own software, I make my own services, I present my curriculum to you without the surveillance entities around us. We don't use any Google services, we don't require any of the platforms. The parasite with the mind of God can go fuck itself as far as I'm concerned. But I'm a fossil, a coelacanth. You can drag me up out of the water and look at me and think, wow, 400 million years and you're still here? But of course, everything I have to say is otherwise irrelevant. Because you already have come to the assumption that the platforms are necessary. Because life can't be lived without them anymore. And I recognize that I am therefore not alive. I am undead. But you can learn something from interviewing a vampire. And so now I wish to proceed to my exit interview for this semester. In the undeadness of knowing that we don't need the machine needs us, and we're allowed to set the terms, but in order to do that, we'd have to know the law, the technology, and the politics, and we'd have to be good at it. Because otherwise, we wind up where your grandchildren wind up, doom-scrolling, in doom. Doom not in the sense of the unsurvival of the human race. I have no idea what will happen to generations after I'm dead is obscure to me. But things that meant being human in my time will have become doomed. And the breadth of what will become doomed is not easily determined by practicalities. If the Chinese Communist Party wishes to make a network which will extinguish the very idea of freedom, soon it will be able to. It can't right now. Where is Pengshan? But very soon it will. And it is a highly disciplined and thoughtful and capable organization of 83 million people ruling a quarter of the world's population. And if it succeeds, that's part of the human destiny. It doesn't frighten me because I know it's coming. It doesn't puzzle me because I can see Hong Kong. It should puzzle and frighten you. So what is it that happens now? What do we do? One of the peculiarities of our moment is a plethora of angst and not very good solutions. The solutions are solutions which are essentially industrial age solutions for industrial age organizations. Forms of regulation or control which assume that the nature of how humans and the net live together can be decapitated. Whether that's by doing the Peng Shuai routine with Jack Ma under Chinese Communist Party control, or it's the digital markets and digital societies initiatives in the European Union, or it's some mysterious thing which Lena is going to do with the Federal Trade Commission, which is going to handicap the platforms and return democracy to life in the United States. All of these are based upon the idea that what we're facing is an industrial problem and we can solve it with industrial solutions, corporate reorganizations, procedural regulations, output flow meters on the pipes carrying the poison or whatever. All of which are fine and won't work, because they address the problem at the wrong place. The assumption of the governments, or at least of these forms of governments, like the assumption of the individual user slash consumer slash used, that these entities out there, these big things, are necessary, generates an assumption about the span of things we can do. The spectrum of our choices is all the things that we could choose on the basis of the necessity of these platforms. And the legal regulatory systems have an interest in exaggerating the necessity of the platforms, because it's the idea that they are some kind of public necessities which justifies the regulations it is undertaking. We must do this because these things have to exist, And if they're going to exist, they have to behave the way we as a society or we as a Communist Party want them to. And that's not a tenable way of understanding these conditions from my point of view. I think it reflects the thought processes of people who haven't been living with the technology and the politics and the law very long, and for whom the technology is still fundamentally mysterious. So let me go back to what I said poorly in week three. The net from this point of view is made of services. From the point of view of you as individuals or you as businesses, the net consists of services. I receive and send email. I have a calendar. I have a way to remember things. I have a way to share my memories of things with other people. I have a voice in the net that I can use. These are services. The general process by which improvement, development, better social life is going on at the moment is for those services to be provided magically for free by organizations which act as behavior accumulators for the parasite of the mind of God. You get your email, you get your calendar, you get your corporation's course, you get various services, and at each juncture you surrender information about your behavior to the intermediaries of the service provider. Wow, we have pretty amazing services. Yes, they have pretty amazing knowledge of your life. Why did that trade occur? Because it occurred in the market, say the market managers, and all we need to do is to fix the market so they occur better. Not good enough, say the entrepreneurs. I have pretty amazing newer services that I would like to offer people for magic free in return for yet more behavior information. I will run excellent e-payment systems in which nobody will ever be anonymous buying vegetables anymore. I will run microcredit that raises the lives of working women in agricultural societies, but I will keep track of their period. I will do this, and I will do that, and I will do some wonderful thing else, and all I will do is to accumulate a little more behavior data. And each one of those things, each one of those fine, shiny, new, red-painted services, is collecting information about behavior which is centralized. Maybe under the control of a perfect autocracy, maybe under the control of a perfect duopoly in ad tech, maybe under the control of a mixture of government and private entities, but always eager for more behavior data. And the correct way to think of that is not as though these were companies or governments eager for behavior data, but to understand that there is a single form of life inside our net, made of software, created by us, an entity which metabolizes human behavior and secretes into the network hormones generating more behavior for it to consume. A true metabolism, a parasitic metabolism, a metabolism in which that software entity, which has a face we call Facebook, and a face we call Instagram, and a face we call Google Meet, and a face we call Zoom, that consolidated entity, that software structure, getting behavior, eating behavior, secreting more stimuli for behavior. That entity I call the parasite of the mind of God because it possesses a view of the human race from the smallest details about each individual to the largest emergent properties of human behavior across the whole collective of all of us. That entity which sees all of that and which uses all of that to generate more engagement with it is parasitizing the process by which human beings learn. It's parasitizing your processes of learning. Again and again, the writing shows the consequence of the fact that we actually had the sheer arrogance to collect full tuition last year for not having a functioning library. People in this room now, halfway through law school, who have never attended a law school or a working library, but you paid full price for it. The writing that you do shows the consequence of the replacement of the library with Google. A process of research in which the parasite's ability to find and hand you little bits of knowledge in return for your behavior has replaced the feeling of walking into the library and spending all day pulling books off the shelf, everything you know of that could possibly help you, and everything adjacent on the shelf to everything that could possibly help you, and carting it back to a desk and sitting there and just reading until you know. The parasite doesn't want that. All that reading until you know shit doesn't do any engaging for you. No swiping, no clicking, no punching. And apparently the law school doesn't care anymore, because it told you that it was entitled to take full price from you for offering you something called law school, which didn't offer that experience, which is essential to becoming a lawyer, not optional. And then what you write begins to show the consequences of that process, in which I got these things, now I have them, they're enough, I don't need to do more, I have them, Google gave them to me, they're the right ones. Right for what? And if the dean thinks, we need fewer books in the library, we need to get these books out because then students will be able to socialize better in the spaces where the shelves used to be. That sounds right. Gee, great. Can we take a grant to do more student social justice stuff and fewer books in the library? But you needed both of those things. You don't want to trade one for the other. Except that you are, once the machine is the primary teacher. I'm not going to go back to explain why that cabins the law student's autonomy. I'm going to explain why that reduces the amount of justice in human society. Because that's not really what it sounds like to let every brain on earth learn whatever it wants without regard to the ability to pay or the means of government. In order to do that, we have to have made a different bargain about how services are rendered and who owns the information upon which learning depends. So it's not terribly surprising that when I come to what should be done about all this, my feeling is the turn that we need to take occurred far earlier on the road than the did we break up Facebook in 2022 or not? Or did we require better content moderation of the platforms in 2023, or did we not? I am, after all, going to say that we needed to take a different exit from the expressway we are now on. We needed to take it earlier, and we needed to take it with a different map in mind. The platforms are not our problem. They're a symptom of the problem. Even the parasite with the mind of God itself, which is the disease of which the platforms are the symptom. The actual presence of the parasite in the network is the problem. That Facebook or Twitter or Weibo or Taobao or Amazon are the problem is a mistake. The symptom of the problem is the presence of so many forms of provision of service in return for behavior. Naturally, if the parasite with the mind of God is lurking at the center of the web we've made, then we will have a lot of things that do the work of trading services for behavior data, which will all come back in the end to the metabolism of the behavior data. And we will have governments that think, oh my God, all that behavior data, now we could have social stability and harmonious work under the mandate of heaven and all of the rest of it. Because it's the presence of the parasite that causes this to be true. The way the behavior change in the human being is the consequence of the introduction of the rabies virus to to its neural system. What is happening to us, I have said in the writing you haven't been forced to read, what is happening to us is the nausea accompanying metamorphosis. We're having that scary notion that we are becoming different, that there is something that is happening to us that we should be able to exert our effort to expel. Many years back, I filed an amicus brief in the United States Supreme Court with my then writing partner, Daniel Carlin, in a case called Planned Parenthood of Southeastern Pennsylvania against Casey, in which we tried to explain to the Supreme Court, I think relatively effectively, what happens if you take away a right which an entire generation of human beings has thought to be its own. And one part of that brief was an effort to explain to the Supreme Court how much ugly and uninteresting work it would have to do if it overruled Roe against Wade and faced all of the consequences of attempting to do that in human society. That brief is mostly banished from the net, I discovered, assuming it was there. And now I have to put it back this week because I feel relatively strong that people should know that, like, 30 years ago we thought this, and the Supreme Court thought, and it came to good conclusions, and changing the judges doesn't change the outcome of all that thinking really at all. But as I have been thinking about that, as I have been realizing that I had to digitize and resurrect the Casey brief, I also realized that it was a pretty good metaphor in the direction of what I'm talking about now. Because that physiological change at the center of the net is doing to all of the human race what we are suddenly proposing to do to the women of the United States. A kind of, as Judge Reeves in the district court in June against the Mississippi Women's Health Center wrote, a kind of universal gaslight, in which we are pretending that what we are still doing is what we used to do, in which nothing has changed, even though power has shifted, so that it is maddeningly far away and eerily close. So that everything seems to depend upon systems in which we are very actively engaged and in which we don't actually have any control of everything, all moderated by some forms of power that we can barely understand. But we can be pretty sure that if they look like Mark Zuckerberg, we don't want them. Once again, I admit, I knew that long ago, too. But he did do more harm to the human race than anybody else his age then and now, at both ages, and nobody can doubt it anymore. And yet, if what we think we're going to do is fix the problem by fixing Zuckerberg, then surely we have misunderstood. Here, then, is the problem. The market for services is screwed up, but it's not because it's a market, and it's not because it's a failed market for services. It's because it permits a thing which is evil, like poisoning the air and water or working children to death and denying them an education. It's simply not a moral way to function. But what difference does that make? It's functioning. And if it can convince us that it is necessary, then we will find a way to rationalize the harm it does. And even if we think we're not rationalizing the harm it does, if we treat that structure of technology as the inevitable architecture, then that's enough rationalization for today, thank you. That will get the system to live until tomorrow. What is wrong, then, with the way we provide services? Well, first of all, we charge behavior data for them. Okay? If you wanted the simplest possible blunt instrument element, it would be don't allow people to trade behavior data for fundamental services. And if you want to talk about a form of regulation, if you want to imagine some legislation in your mind, which it would be a good thing to do, nobody happened to write such a paper, but it's a fine essay. If you wanted to explain what regulation is for, regulation is for prohibiting immoral ways of doing business that cause massive social externalities that are harmful and that could be prevented, whether it is collapsing textile factories in Bangladesh, or it is child labor in Afghanistan, or it is poisoning the air and the water in the People's Republic of China, doesn't really matter. The problem is the same one. Conceive that narrative. Immorality in business practices causes harm. Let us prohibit the immorality and require businesses to operate in less immoral ways. That's a layer. I won't deny it. I'm not terribly, I'm intellectually convinced that such regulation is appropriate and necessary, but that doesn't mean it's going to occur. It won't. What will occur instead is data protection regulation and moderation requirements. Moderation requirements are a substitute for international treaties of censorship. If you think about it, the effort to get the platforms now treated as super necessary, they will always be there, and we can use them to do even more essential social work. Moderation requirements are basically efforts to get multilateral parties crossing international boundaries to do the work of limiting harms that occur from speech. One of the problems of trying to limit harms that occur from speech in a multinational world of a cross-species nervous system is that it's really hard for one country to do it at a time. This is the problem if the People's Republic of China decides that saying that you were raped by a standing committee member of the Politburo is really harmful social speech and it should be stamped out. Even if you are the most powerful regulators of speech in the net anywhere in the human race and you possess a total monopoly of violence and you can get the International Olympic Committee to do your bidding, still, it is really, really hard to moderate where is feng shui out of the entire human race all at once. But if there were moderation requirements that effectively allowed red notices on human beings and their speech to be issued across country boundaries through banning on Facebook, that would be damn convenient. So let's bang on Facebook. The CCP, of course, faced a really important question a decade ago. Are we going to let those things in or not? When they decided, no, we're going to ban them everywhere here, they effectively eliminated their control over them, which is why they then had to go back to work looking for other ways to do the job extraterritorially. But any of you who have followed the pain and suffering of the China affairs teachers around the world as they try and cope with the question how to deal with the national security law when they have remote instruction students in Hong Kong and some inside China, and how do we maintain security for people to learn in our courses according to our idea of learning if the party might decide to act against them or their relatives for what they say. Now, you understand, of course, that this has caused immense angst among China scholars, but no angst whatever among Columbia Law School's management, faculty, and administrators who have ignored the whole question as though it did not exist. Which is a reminder of what all of these efforts to push on better moderation and more international control of the platforms fundamentally amount to two bad ideas heaped up together as though they were going to make one good idea. Let us treat the platforms as so essentially necessary that we begin to structure the world's public law system around them. And let us engage in forms of cross-societal censorship by private parties that we could not ever get agreement among states to do for themselves. That will be one outcome of where we will go instead of the comprehensive regulation of behavior collection. The second thing we will do is pass data protection laws. The United States will get around to it in the administration following this one, whatever type is. The European Commission is, of course, deep into the weeds of it already. GDPR exists. California state government has done things. And the Chinese Communist Party, in its role in managing the civil society, the People's Republic of China, is deep into data protection, too. It's odd because the forms in which data protection is usually described, the Chinese Communist Party cannot use. But it's a demonstration of the inadequacy of the concepts that they are fundamentally adapted to these purposes everywhere. Michi and I are spending a great deal of our time now on the data protection bill, now suddenly once again moving to the Indian Parliament after 2 years of gathering dust, and which, like other data protection law around the world, begins from what is the great failed premise of this effort, which is that what we are protecting is data. That is what data protection law does. It protects data. We don't need data protection. We need people protection. And that will be the second great problem that will arise as we go through the near future regulatory history of governments and the net trying to make civil society better. They will protect data. It's easy to describe in a law professorial kind of way what to do instead. We need people protection with respect to data law. That means we need to begin by understanding what people's rights are. We need to legislate to protect their rights, and then whatever is consistent with the duties that the rights of the people as individuals require, we should facilitate. We should make possible. And whatever is not in keeping with their rights, we should not facilitate. And sometimes we should discourage, and occasionally we should prohibit. This will not suffice to explain what ought to be done to protect privacy in China, because the Chinese Communist Party cannot begin by analyzing on the basis of the people's rights. That causes far too many conflicts with other important social goals. Whatever happens, Chinese data protection regulation will be for the purpose of social stability, which is the legitimate, entirely legitimate aim for which government is working. That means that human flesh search engines and abusive consumer practices and abusive lending by non-bank, shadow bank entities to smartphones and bitcoins and all kinds of other things will be prohibited because data protection. And it's not just the Chinese Communist Party which would say in some footnote, all this stuff about data protection, etc., does not apply to the state. On the contrary, that just happened in the Indian Parliament. The last piece moving as the train started finally puffing out of the station in the current IRC report on the legislation is the sudden appearance of provisions that say any Indian agency of government may, by order of the Prime Minister, suspend everything that has to do with this data protection regulation for its purposes. Which is not fundamentally different from the relation of the French government to GDPR. Which is, oh yeah, all that stuff is very good, but the Military Platforms Bill says our intelligence and social security agencies can do whatever they want. Which is not so very different from whatever will emerge in the United States, which will feel a lot more rights protective than those pieces of legislation, but still will treat government surveillance and government listening and government access to information as different. Because of peculiarities, I hope lasting peculiarities, in the American constitutional system, all of that will have a more pro-individual feeling here, and it will talk the language of rights. But that doesn't mean that it will clarify those rights, that it will declare them in a new way that will last a couple of hundred years, the way the work at the end of the 18th century did. All of that is next term's class, if you like, in the second part of course, called Part One. But for now, let's just say that these are the two lines down which societies will go in the near term, 5-year term, 7-year term, of as the short term. These are the paths down which societies will go as they attempt to regulate the situation of pervasive behavior collection in society. They will treat the platforms as essential, permanent parts of human life. They will regard them as the sensors of first resort, and they will attempt to work out inter-societal bargains with the necessary platforms to do their censoring for them. And they will make data protection legislation, which protects flows of data, purporting as it does so to protect consumer welfare and public safety and so on, but which will not declare the rights of human beings with respect to the collection of their behavior, for example, which is what would work from my point of view. It's still simplistic, but it would work. It would do important things. If we said, we don't need a federal communications commission in the United States because telecoms is no longer a separate sector doing anything, and broadcast regulation in the United States is essentially vestigial, what we need is an agency that regulates behavior collection throughout the economy. Healthcare vertical here, finance vertical there, consumer advertising there, and so on, but all of it joined together by the reality of behavior collection as the primary process we are attempting to regulate the consequences of, we could do well. We will be required to think in environmental terms about such regulation. And when I say we will be required to think in environmental terms, that has two immediate meanings for lawyers. One, consent is irrelevant. That's not how we do environmental law. We're dealing with the law of externalities. We don't think that the correct solution is individual bargaining bilaterally throughout society. We think the relevant job is the creation of technically sophisticated, highly adaptable, changeable standards, which can be enforced by a standards maker whose role it is to learn about society and make administrative judgments subject to judicial review and intervention. That's the way we built environmental law in our world. And I don't just mean here in the United States. There isn't any place in the world where we consider it to be acceptable to have bilateral bargaining over how much poison will be in your family's drinking water, or how much disease will be caused in your family by bad air. Nobody, certainly not the Chinese Communist Party, thinks that the solution to cancer villages is to have villages negotiate with industrial parties for how much cancer they will have. But of course, the solution to what to do about cancer villages is to change the entire economy, as is the solution to the other great environmental problem of our time, namely the destruction of the climate and therefore the destruction of the biosphere. Nobody thinks that that's an individual bargaining problem. There may be people who think that carbon pricing is a good idea, and carbon markets are a good idea, and offset markets are a good idea, and border reallocations, that is, environmental tariffs, are a good idea. But everybody realizes at the end of the day that this is not to be done by bargaining in individuals or among organizations. These are societal questions on which not just individual societies, but the human race as a whole have to consider ends and means collectively. To say that about privacy is only to point to the obvious consequence of the fact that each decision that we allegedly make when we click on terms of service, yes, I want to do this, by no means allows any process in society to weigh collectively the externalities, positive and negative, and to make administrative decisions about what we ought to do together. Sometimes this is celebrated as a source of great innovation. I don't happen to think much of that argument, but okay, it's an argument. The question that rises for us is, who judges that argument? One consumer negotiating with one insurance company at a time? or the society as a whole. So if we are in the end to adapt ourselves to a structure of regulation which addresses the root problem in our net, which is behavior collection, from this point of view, I'm not done finding root problems to assess, but on this branch, where we see the problem of comprehensive behavior collection in return for commodity services causing secondary harms of a very substantial kind, from bad body image in teenage human beings to growth of misinformation and hate speech in politics, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Everybody's got a big list of the harms now. If we think of this in terms of what regulatory structures will serve the purpose, then surely we are thinking more about environmental structures than consent-based structures, which is not what the privacy invaders and their subcontractors want. They want us to believe these are all matters of consumer choice, which is why we shouldn't believe that story for an instant. When we enacted environmental legislation in the United States in the sainted Nixon administration, we began with a series of arrangements, all of which are worthy of consideration in the situation where we find ourselves now. The crucial first move is the National Environmental Policy Act, the requirement that public authorities, in their engagement with the private economy, assess the environmental impacts of what they do in a formalized way which can be subject to judicial review. This, the idea that what you have is a policy layer which acts by requiring government consciously to think and behave and subject itself to the rule of law in particular structures, is a pretty good emulation of what we would need at the root of a system of privacy regulation in a developed society. The whole point is to use government action to enforce 3D thinking instead of 2D thinking. If you're going to transcend the idea of individual decisions to disclose or not disclose, yes, I want to use this service, check. Things in terms of service didn't read. If you want to address that, using the benefit of state authority and coherence, then what you want to do is make the state do its thinking out loud, and you want to require the state to think in 3D environmental terms, not about what individuals are deciding or what firms are doing, but about what the societal goals are and the standards necessary to prevent them from being frustrated. Behavioral autonomy impact statements. And it's not what they would be called, that's not what I would call them, but that's what, from the point of view of our conversation, they are. Whatever this thing is government is doing or allowing private industry to do using resources in which the public is intrinsically involved, what are the impacts on, and then we need to establish the goals. Some of them are common. Like, if you were imagining the legislation as I would write it, the right of every brain on earth to learn whatever it wants, wherever it is, regardless of the ability to pay and the whims of government. But also, much more, what can I say, practicable or low-flung goals or goals no Eben would ever think of, like, you know, preventing the healthcare system from being biased in the direction of the profits of the insurers on the basis of the use of information about individual patients. And again, in finance, in healthcare, in voting, in advertising to consumers, etc., you could begin to evolve the kinds of impacts that you would require governments to assess, administrators to think about and decide about in formal cost-benefit analysis terms, followed by thoughtful judicial review of the propriety of agency action. Then, of course, you can imagine the verticals yielding legislation themselves, like the Clean Air Act, like the Clean Water Act, like Superfund, efforts to get to particular problems within the different verticals of society.
set again around standards which are appropriate in a particular context, enforceable through forms of litigation which allow judicial review of administrative action. And here, of course, we then come to which agencies are responsible for the healthcare privacy law, which is not HIPAA, and which agencies are responsible for the educational technologies law, which does not exist, which is why the Google Classroom and the iPad and all sorts of other stuff are flooding into schools to collect the behavior of children ever more. Which is why Canvas spies on you at least as much as it delivers curriculum. Because we haven't prohibited that. Because we haven't even regulated that. Because we don't even appear to give a shit. So, like clean air after 1968, the answer is now you have to start caring about it. Administration and judicial review will make you care about it. We can then imagine structures of legislative address to the problems at a problem-focused level. Behavior is our problem. Behavior collection is our problem. Spying on children. Turning the healthcare system into a data and behavior collection system which colonizes human bodies and which only offers them health in return for the surrender of personal life data. All of those can be thought of as foci of specific regulatory regimes, generally outlined by legislatures and generally implemented by agencies dedicated to the collection of expertise necessary to carry out their functions, subject to the overwatch of a judicial system well aware of the requirement that all of these things comport with due process and meet the demands of the statute and have been made as rules in a regulatory process which is acceptable, etc., etc. I can't go home after that. It's not the end of the workday as far as I'm concerned, but it's a powerful part of the story. And as long as we're going to have powerful governments around the world determined to create regulation and to address the big powers of the internet, we should at least have recommendations to offer them which aren't foolish, as their own recommendations are likely to be, and as other people will want their recommendations to be. These things are as impossible to imagine as the Clean Air and Clean Water Act were in 1960. So what? I didn't want anybody over watching my learning when I was in school, and I don't want anybody over watching yours, and I don't care whether Canvas is getting better or worse. If KGB had come to me and said, you, everybody in the Soviet Union, including you foreigners, you're all going to carry a device which is going to spy on you 24/7, and it's going to make KGB a much better place, okay, I don't want KGB to be the right place, let alone the better right place. I have no desire to improve the Chinese Communist Party's ability to know the life of every person in China. I understand their want for it. I understand that that's not pure evil, that's not the viciousness of the Chinese Communist Party. That's a new and better way of achieving social stability and harmonious operation under the mandate of heaven, and any emperor who could have had it for the last 2,000 years would have taken it in a heartbeat. But still, that's not my aspiration for the human race. Canvas ought not to exist the way it exists now. It used to be that Columbia Courseworks was based on Sakai, a free software form of course delivery which didn't spy on its users. Could they have made Sakai better? Yes. I mean, Sakai was open source software. We all made it better all the time. I successfully saved Sakai from the patent aggression of even more commercialized forms of curricular delivery, which States wanted to wipe it out. Columbia had the benefit of it. They threw away it, they threw it away in order to get analytics, which really means spying on learning. I'm not in favor of spying on learning. It's not a question of efficiency. It's a question of morality and value. Is that responsive, or am I missing the point from you?
Well, I was just thinking that, you know, if we can get something from exchange as well, better platforms, better services.
I don't think that's true, but maybe you want to say, Evan, your wiki really sucks. You should put this course on Canvas. It would be so much better. Was that what you were telling me about? But no, but you could be. I mean, you could really say, Evan, the fact that what you use is an open source wiki, which is constantly being worked on by thousands of people around the world who are trying to make it better, isn't good enough. You can't really make it better by doing that. We can't really make it better by having wiki communities that really care about education and that are really trying to make better wikis and that tinker with stuff all the time. What we really need is to spy on the students in the courses. Then we will have good wikis. Maybe you're right. If that is the argument, I'd love to read it. I'd love to think about it. I personally don't believe it, but perhaps I could be persuaded. I can't be persuaded by the mere argument that we're making it better by spying on students. I don't believe it. I simply don't believe it. Now, are we having a conversation again, or am I missing you? I want to be sure that we're in the same place. I don't want to be non-responsive. You mean the exact answer? Would you worry about anybody else breaking in and stealing?
But then that can apply to my own computer.
It could apply to your computer, but if it applies to my wiki server, I have to tell you that I really have to break a sweat. One of the few things I can do is to say to you, if the Chinese Ministry of State Security wants to spy on this course, they must work at it. Because I know how to make them work at it, and that I will do. Right? Again, it's a question of what values our technology supporting. It's not the law school's business what you're writing and reading in my course unless you make it public. In which case, I want you to have the world know what you're doing because you've said so. If you haven't said so, then the fact that the dean would like to know is not important. I don't give a fuck whether you fill out course evaluations. That's not important to me. If you're going to fill out course evaluations, I want to make sure that you do it the right way. My courses have, I hope, always a perfectly bimodal distribution. Hate it, like it. If you're going to fill out course evaluations, please help me achieve my goal. Because I don't actually think that the goal of this is in order to make a better course. I am always trying to make a better course. I am always talking to students about how to make a better course. I do not happen to believe that the statistics computable in course evaluations will help me make a better course. So I don't care. This interfered in my tenure case. Actually, my last untenured course of contract. One of my dear colleagues on the floor of the faculty held up my course evaluation. He said, "Is this good teaching?" I said, "It's Paris, 1912. The premiere of Sacre du Printemps. Fistfights break out in the audience. Do you want to tell me that that means that the Sacre du Printemps are not good music?" It didn't secure me tenure, but it didn't prevent me from getting tenure either, and I'm still standing and talking to you. I understand the concept that the analytics of individual student behavior is somehow baking better course delivery software. I could understand even the slightly more plausible case that it is making better courses or better teaching. I might perfectly well accept that we could summon data to show that, but I don't know how we would summon data to show that it is moral to spy on student learning. I don't know what data that would be. Yes, Lee?
I imagine that you already talked about this with faculty and other professors. And why would then Columbia choose for Canvas? Why they could have open source wikis that would work even better? Do you think they purposely choose this by students?
No. My colleagues, by and large, are as ignorant of what Canvas does as you were when you walked in this room.
But you raised the issue, right?
Yeah. Oh, you mean here in this room? Or in faculty?
In
Since I haven't been in a faculty meeting for 16 years, why would I be disturbed in this room?
So, you think the issue still has to be raised?
No. I mean, I'm happy if you raise it, but my conclusion is I must do the right thing myself in my own country. You think I will succeed well by raising moral issues in this community? Everybody has moral issues to raise in this community. Good luck to them. After 35 years, I know what I think that's worth. What's important to me is delivering an honest course in an honest way to students who pay a ton for it. If I succeed in that, I've done enough. But then, I'm old. You're young. Go fix the world, please. It's you who have to live in it. I will be dead. Of course you should do that. My job now is simply passing it along. If you go someplace and spend 35 years and it hasn't gotten better, then I will not force you to keep doing it. But I will expect you to teach people what is wrong and to help them figure out what's right. And as a lawyer, I will expect you to go and put the hammer down occasionally. Which is why the only form of professional activity that I am thinking about going into for the first time in my seventh decade of life is whether I ought to make a nonprofit, the purpose of which is to hurt universities through the strong student bias. I believe, in the same way that I help other people to plan law practices in the other course, I believe I can viability test a small, extremely aggressive, highly litigious organization which protects student privacy by causing multi-million-dollar embarrassments to universities. And I would start, of course, at home. And the people who should work in such organization are law students who should make their law school tuition back off the back of the funds created by hurting universities to harm student privacy. If I created that virtuous circle in which law students around the country thought that they could get law school paid for and launch their practices by hot-footing universities to destroy student privacy, if I could really make that work, that would be interesting, and I'm actively thinking about that. Trying to get Columbia law faculty to do the moral thing and reject Canvas, I am not thinking. I do not believe in the viability of that activity. But the first sign I see that that would work, yeah, I would be in there doing it. Not necessarily in the room, but pushing ordinance towards the place where it would get fired. Does that help? Is that responsive? You want to say more? I'm surprised. Why don't you want to tell me that's hypocritical?
I think you have, you gave up on this small thing and you want to target something bigger.
Good. I'm old enough now that I'm permitted cynicism. I appreciate that. I have been waiting for a very long time for that to be true. I'm glad that you confirmed to me that it is.
If you were us, what would you do?
I'm going to try today and next Wednesday to say, and then you'll tell me I haven't said a good enough job. But I will tell you the first thing, right? I would leave the phone home today. Right? I would actually begin on the personal level to test what's really essential to me and what isn't. Because after all, I grew up in the household of a second-rate feminist theorist. My mother had three sons, and that was three chances to improve the world. So I will tell you that the personal is volitional. I came to that early by parental influence. Right? I learned that in her consciousness raising sessions in the mid-1960s. The personal. So what I would do if I were you is be personal about it. That's the first thing. It starts inside. I would surveil in myself, introspectively, the question, how much are these essential things making me better? How much of these essential terms are making me worse? And I would experiment with that in a scientific fashion. 1 day a week, then 2 days a week, then 10 days a month, and suddenly you actually begin to figure out what are the things you really need, what are the things you don't really need, and how might you get the things you really need without having to pay for them by filling yourself inside out. As a personal matter, whether you're an engineer or you're not an engineer, whether you're a used who doesn't mind it because I like getting the ads, or you're used who really hates it but doesn't know what the alternatives are, whatever it is, you'll find out once you actually begin to deal. And of course, behind that, I do have a philosophic argument, which has to do with what we call convenience and what it means. My proposition took me a long time. I spent 3 years trying to understand convenience, back in the middle of this last decade when the question became so overwhelmingly important. And I kept hearing from people I work among, your predecessors in this room, that I can't give up this or give up that or give up something else because of the convenience. And that mystified me. In the same way that the conversation about canvases drives me, because I can't imagine thinking about being disemboweled by the machine as convenient. Because I'm a 20th century person. Because I set foot in the Soviet Union. Because when I see the China of today, I see the Soviet Union of the 1970s. Because my relatives are the ones whose brains were deposited by machine gun bullets in a ditch outside Minsk in 1940. Because I can't quite understand what it would mean to call convenient the collaboration with the mechanisms of autocracy and totalitarianism. And yet I understood that the people I was talking to, your colleagues and mine, were people who genuinely meant. They experienced the feeling called convenience. Where I experienced the feeling of walking down a street in Leningrad and being followed by some Vladimir Putin or somebody very much like him, all those little rat-faced guys in the right place that I met in that world. So what made me feel utterly creeped out and deeply worried was convenience. And the question was, what did that mean? And so I spent 3 years reading everything that I could and talking to different kinds of people and thinking again about Spielberg's Minority Report and the Philip K. Dick story behind it and all of the pieces of the science fiction of my childhood from Orwell up. And after a while I got this really eerie feeling because I wasn't being followed by KGB. I was walking in the footsteps of the King of the Undead now. I was the one to follow. Jobs was the one who got there first. And the more I read and the more I thought, the more I understood that if I was gonna cope with the meaning of this thing called convenience, I needed to understand what the jewelry did in the people who put it on. I couldn't wear the ring myself. I couldn't bring myself to do it. I could never bring myself to do it. I still can't. Touch his stuff. Somebody offered me an iPhone to hold for a minute, a member of my family, earlier this month, and I felt the ring, and I couldn't touch it. Right? I couldn't. I just can't. And so I wasn't the guy to go and find out what it was, like all those wonderful people injecting themselves with, you know, some rat poison or other to prove they cure COVID. But I could at least try and figure out what he did in those things. And after a while I realized then, much as I felt awkward following King of the Undead now dead down the street, never wanting to meet him actually, and glad that I wouldn't have to, I realized that what convenience meant, as I've said before, was the transfer of an anxiety. The feeling that we're calling convenience is that an anxiety resident in the human being has been handed to the machine. Not getting lost. Not being out of touch. Not being excluded from the parties of one's friends.
not in the bottom of it getting laid. The anxiety of courtship or dating, or even sex date making, the anxiety of knowing that you won't get lost on your way to an appointment. So that's convenience, and anxiety transferred to the machine. And of course, what I know, and what you know if you think about it yourself, is that the machine transfers anxieties back. Which means that what we call convenience is not actually an honest account of the anxiety level. On the contrary, right? There's an awful lot of dawning recognition in this and other societies around the world that the anxieties being transferred to the machine are smaller than the anxieties being returned, at least for some people in some places at some times. Among the places and the people and the times I realized was law school, here. In other words, my students were suffering anxieties that didn't used to exist. And they were soothing those anxieties with behavior that didn't used to exist, which was collective behavior. Epidemic social isolation put this through the roof, as you know yourselves if you conduct a little, introspection. Alone in those cubicles all that last 16 months, people were soothing themselves with interactions with the machine that were adroitly disguised as interactions with human beings. The consequence of which was a social anxiety of isolation apparently being reduced because the machine stepped in and kept me in touch with people, returned with an anxiety that came from the uncanny valley aspect of Zoom dates and Zoom drinks and Zoom classes and Zoom Passover Seders and all this fake that was the only thing that people had to substitute for the real, which caused them to attempt to substitute the real for the fake, only to discover that there was a lot of social anxiety because they weren't really connected, but they were supposed to be. Once again, of course, I'm a fossil. My attitude was, I will not ever use Zoom during the epidemic at all. And I never did. Not once. Not one millisecond. My life was quiet up there in the 455 days I spent alone in my apartment. And it's true, Zoom would have disturbed the quiet, but it wasn't the quiet that I didn't want Zoom disturbing. I didn't want Zoom disturbing my awareness of the difference between being alone and not being alone. With my students, too. There were lots of other ways to teach, and I taught with them. Having planned for 7 years how to teach with them without video conferencing, let alone without Zoom. So, what would I do if I were you? If I tried not to be a coelacanth, if I tried to behave as though I were a new organism, not 400 million years old and completely evolutionary extinct, I would experiment with the boundaries. I would be transgressive. But I wouldn't go whole hog and become heaven. I couldn't do that if I were you. I couldn't. It wouldn't make any sense. Any more than it would be sensible for me to attempt to use the ring of power.
What about everything else in life that's like convenience and like an anxiety transfer? Like eating processed foods or, telling white lies to family members because you don't want to actually confront whatever is bad and solve the problem. Is all of that just okay too?
If what you're asking me is, does human dissociation provide a necessary psychological defense to human beings, the answer is yes. The most important and obvious example is the one that Ernst Becker gave in 1974, the denial of death. It's true. If human beings couldn't deny death, they'd be psychotic all the time, if Becker was correct. So it is obvious that our ability to dissociate, to take things out of the world we see and operate in, is indeed terribly important and protective for you. It's also true that whether we're talking about Evan in particular in his 17-year psychoanalysis, or we're talking about you here now, dissociation is also a dangerous and destructive process, capable of hiding trauma and making it worse and
inhibiting healing and transmitting our traumatic informations to our children and to others whom we think we love, and etc. So it's evident that we have some complexity to encounter. And you're right. I mean, all of those things, you're right. White lies to my family? No. I'm the oldest person in my family now. I'm the one who stands on the edge of the grave. Everybody older than me is gone. I have nobody to tell white lies. My brothers? Their children? My brother's children? No, I'm an honest man. I don't have to dissociate the realities of family. When my mother died, we had no unfinished business. We both knew it. That's the benefit of the end of the dissociation. Processed food? Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm not going to be judgmental, but you know. I eat white rice. Sensible people do, in my opinion. The world of rice eaters knows that you should mill it first. But I'm perfectly prepared to believe that, you know, veganism to save the planet? No, we'll do that after I'm gone. I'm not eating mushrooms. I'm not canceling my relationship to the animal world for this. I'm too old. You want to be judgmental? Go ahead, be judgmental. But as you say, I mean, the question how we work denial, how we function with respect to our internal conflicts is the thing that matters, not whether we do it or not. If you want to binge watch, you know, whatever it is, this way instead of that way, in order to deal with the fact that your brain is tired and it's exam season and you damn well aren't the slave to law school, good for you. Is that also dissociative behavior? Yes. Might it hurt you in the long run? Yes. Is it grades that it will hurt? I don't give a damn. But you see, I mean, we have to learn to live with our conflicts. Which is why leaving the phone home one day a week is not becoming a digital vegan. It's not adopting an ideological proposition. It's exploring. And if, as it turns out, for so many of my students and other young people I know, if it turns out that the minute those things are gone, it's suddenly better and quieter and more healthy, and you feel better about it, then I don't want to lecture about you should get more exercise. I just want to say, I should want to take a walk. Is that responsible? Okay, since we have only 5 more minutes, I'm not going to systematically advance the resolutions until next week. What should we be talking about? What are the questions?
Can we go back a bit to the elements of privacy? I just wanted to clarify, regarding the anonymity and security, are violations of those essential for autonomy to be violated in your opinion?
Well, definitionally, yes. If autonomy is violated, it's because a violation of secrecy and anonymity occurs. You could say to me that that underclassifies, that there are forms of autonomy restriction which don't involve either violations of secrecy or privacy. I certainly would admit that any formal analysis is incomplete, that Gödel's proof element of our conversation. So you could, for example, write a wonderful essay by pointing to forms of autonomy violation which don't involve either secrecy or anonymity violation. That would be a useful piece of intellectual work, which I would respect. I don't care that it violates the formal relations I set out. That's not important. The formal relations I set out are there to create what I think of as minimum conditions for the maintenance of autonomy. If we are routinely violating the secrecy and anonymity of human beings, they will lose their autonomy. That doesn't prove that's the only way to lose it. That's not the logical claim. Is that helpful? Where was there another question here that I... Oh, good. To say we can avoid selling the thing you told them to that person over there is one kind of regulatory ambition. And, you know, for all of the crazinesses that are embedded in it, GDPR is an attempt intellectually to approach that idea. As though we could think of data as going into object X and passing out of object X, and as long as the thing is the same thing, we could say you shouldn't have done that unless you had consent. I object to the consent part, as usual, for the general reason, but here, my real concern is we're not really thinking about data anymore. We're thinking about inferences from data, conclusions drawn from data. Now we are back to the point about what algorithms are. Right? People analyze as though the algorithm was some mysterious magic spell which, when applied to the information gathered about you, put the algorithms that we call AI, which is not AI, which is really machine learning, except machine learning is not really machine learning, the algorithms we're talking about are pattern matching programs. Programs that find patterns in large collections of supposedly similar information. Pattern matching programs just say, this is more like that than it is like other things that aren't that. Think, as I said in the comments on Amoy's paper, think of this like a spam filter. A spam filter is a pretty good example of what we routinely and laughably call AI. The spam filter is a very simple algorithm. The program is trivial. It enacts one little way of implementing Bayesian statistics of a simple kind. What makes the spam filter isn't the little probability calculator, which is trivial code. What makes the spam filter is the training data. What I do with the spam filter is I take that very simple little program, and then I show it 60,000 pieces of spam. And I say, that's spam. And then I show it 30,000 pieces of what the jargon of this calls ham, that is, email you actually wanted. And we say, that stuff is ham. And then we show it a bunch of email, and we say, is it more like that or more like this? And the algorithm says, with 45% confidence, it's more like that. And we say, okay, spam, put it in the folder. Oh, no, says the algorithm, it's 58.2% likely that it's ham. Okay, deliver it to the human being and see what she thinks of it. Now, the algorithm is trivial. The training data is arbitrary. If we don't know what the training data was and what all the data is that's come in since that time, we won't know what the system will do by studying the code. We can't have the vaguest idea. Code won't tell us anything. The algorithm is blank. Yet, after we have done this a bunch of times with you, the 30,000 training pieces here and the 30,000 training pieces there and the 70,000 pieces of your mail, suddenly we have a thing which has a weird emergent property. Because there is no technical definition of spam. Spam is email you didn't want. And ham is email you did want. And that's not mathematical or scientifically defined. That's your unconscious mind. That's the whole of your unconscious responses to the stream of your email. And yet, this trivial piece of code that wasn't anything, and this training data that was arbitrary, and some experience with you, and suddenly we have a computer system which is emulating your unconscious. Quite effective. A few percent of the time, you'll object, no, that was really spam, or no, that was really ham. You shouldn't have got a bad filter. But most of the time, it's going to get your unconscious judgments exactly right. What the hell was that? How could that be? It's an emergent property of simple things. Regulating things, transparentizing the things, demanding disclosure of the things. No. None of it will get to that. The only thing that will get to that is the recognition that human beings' unconsciousnesses are more visible from outside than from inside. Thank you, Dr. Freud. was the whole point of 20th century psychology, if it wasn't behaviorism. That's what the simple code and the trivial training data did. Now, not to sell that to third parties? How old would you regulate? Those were inferences. Those were thoughts they had. Unless they're not rights holders, unless they don't have a right to think, how can we take that away from them? The better solution would have been not to engage with them in the first place. Why should you show your unconscious to them in order to receive your email? Write your own spam filter. Your class is over. See you in a week.